The fundamental question we've got to ask ourselves is, did the organization that got compromised take all reasonable measures to protect your data or information about you? And if that organization did take reasonable measures, then rather than vilifying them, what we should probably do is say, well, okay, what was it about this attack that allowed them to successfully get in, and what do we need to do to, in order to stop this happening in the future?
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Raj Samani, Senior Vice President, Chief Scientist from Rapid7. And today we're discussing some of Raj's experiences working alongside law enforcement for cybercrime cases. So Raj, thanks for joining. It's wonderful to have you on the show. I know it's quite early morning where you are because you are on the opposite end of the world. So I appreciate you getting up early to have this interview with me.
Good morning and thank you for the invitation.
So Raj, I really want to speak about your experience, and I've done a little bit of research about some of the cases that you have sort of worked on and alongside of. So I'm keen to sort of explore those in a little bit more fidelity in a moment. But maybe let's start with, you have sort of worked alongside law enforcement agencies. So what were some of the cases that you collaborated on? Talk to me a little bit more about them.
Well, so there's been a few, and actually predominantly started with this botnet by the name of B-Bone. I know it sounds made up, but it's truly not. And this was a malicious downloader that was infecting computers across the globe. As we started to do the analysis on trying to understand the scale of the issue, once we actually, you know, what we call it is it's sinkholing. So once we actually sinkholed the malicious infrastructure hosted by criminals, what we realized was that the number of infected computers was considerably higher than we originally anticipated. So we thought, you know, a few thousand infections a day. I think on day one, it was like 38,000 infected systems we found just on a single day. And that number just continued to increase. So that was the first one. But I think, you know, the piece of work that I'm most proud of was, you know, working and co-founding the No More Ransom Initiative. Ransomware is obviously the hottest topic, and it has been for a number of years. So with this particular initiative, what we did was we developed a collaboration with law enforcement, whereby we made available free decryption keys and worked on sort of trying to disrupt ransomware operations. And, you know, when we launched it in 2016, we had 7 free decryptors. So in other words, 7 families of ransomware that we could freely give your information back without having to pay the criminals. And today we're at about 160 with over 150 partners. And so, yeah, there's been a lot of work, and there's a lot of work that happens which doesn't result in, you know, lots of press as well. So I'd say it's kind of part of the course now. If you work in cybersecurity, there is a need to be able to collaborate and work with law enforcement across the globe.
Yeah, most definitely. You're absolutely right. Would you say that from working alongside of law enforcement historically, you've sort of learned a lot which you've brought forward in your career today in terms of knowledge, insights, any of those types of things?
Well, I think everything has contributed because, you know, when I started in this industry, cybercrime wasn't what it is today, whereby we were dealing with probably low-end attacks, what we used to call war dialing. And now we're dealing with things that have an impact on geopolitics, for example. So when we identified a case targeting the Winter Olympics, that was a case that we strongly believe to be operated from you know, malicious nation state groups. And so, and if you'd have told me like 15, 20 years ago, well, you know, you're investigating attacks associated with the Winter Olympics, we would have said, well, come on, that's a bit far-fetched. And yet today that's normal operations, I think. So the adversary has fundamentally shifted and changed. It's become a lot more professional than it ever has done. And so it's important to try to understand what's actually occurring. And, you know, a really good example of that was COVID. When COVID actually hit, what we kind of recognized fairly quickly was the number of threat actors that were involved in leveraging and utilizing COVID as a hook to try to infect or target individuals and companies for that matter was just like you know, kicking over a hornet's nest. It was like almost every possible capable threat actor out there was leveraging and using COVID. And so I'd say all of the above has contributed towards this continuous learning requirement that exists within our industry.
And from my research that I've done around B-Bone, I mean, it was quite large in terms of, you know, a lot of people like responding to it, a lot of people having their version of the story. Would you say that there are sort of, I hate to call it rumors, but do you think that people sort of had their view of B-Bone was maybe slightly skewed to what you sort of saw in terms of being a little bit more closer to the case and really working on the ground?
That's the challenge that we face with any digital attack is from a cybersecurity perspective, it's asymmetrical in terms of the amount of information that you have. And so, for example, we had some assumptions going into this, which is the scale of the impact or the location of the victims. And that becomes important because predominantly because we need to try to understand which countries are the most targeted. So as we bring this case forward to law enforcement, then we can fundamentally find a partner to work with. So what they want to know is predominantly the scale of the impact, specifically within their territories. And so we constantly were dealing with this kind of asymmetrical component around the amount of information we had. What turns out when we disrupt the criminal infrastructure, implement the sinkholing, we actually then get the full transparency of what the scale of the issue is. And so I see this as everybody has their opinion, absolutely. But of course, that opinion is shaped by the amount of information accessible and available to you at the time. And what's available and accessible for you at the time may not, and in many cases, isn't actually an accurate reflection of what's going on. And so with that particular case, it was, we learned so much about the scale of the attack, more so after we did the action than before. But of course, that doesn't mean what we did before was appropriate. It just means we actually didn't have the amount of information we needed in order to be able to accurately scope out the scale of the campaign.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I guess things, as you go along and you do those investigations, more things become uncovered. Do you think it's hard as well? So for example, if there's like a well-known data breach, there's so many versions of whether it's a vendor or consultancy or someone internal that has their view then of the story. So it's quite hard to navigate because, like you said, some bits of information are included and some are not, which is like a key piece. And then it's probably hard as someone trying to follow these stories as a consumer or even clients looking into it because every vendor or whoever, their line of questioning and the line of details in their story seems to change. Do you think that then that just adds more complexity then to the outside world for people looking in on some of these cases and some of these breaches?
Well, I think it stresses upon the biggest problem we have, which is we truly suffer from a lack of transparency in as much that when we think about these breaches, invariably the only thing that we seem to focus on is who is at fault and who was behind it. And yet I would argue that those are probably, well, I'd say those are probably two of the least pieces of most relevant information. Look, if you're a data subject, then knowing who was compromised is obviously going to be a key area of interest. But from an industry perspective, what we really want to try to understand is what were the approaches, what were the tools, what was actually done in order to be able to compromise? You know, having that level of transparency becomes imperative because then if we have that information, we can then make the playbook, as it were, the playbook of the threat actors accessible and available to every company on the planet. This actually will allow us the opportunity to be able to protect other organizations because, you know, if we learn and know more about what the bad guys are doing or the bad girls are doing, then, of course, we've got the opportunity to be able to reduce the likelihood of other organizations being compromised. The other thing that I think we often kind of neglect is what is the scale of the economic impact or what is the scale of the impact? And invariably, that's something that is very rarely reported on because we jump from breach to breach, like chasing these headlines, whereby what we want to try to understand is what is the scale of the issue as well. And so it is a particularly maybe the word is litigious, but, you know, it is an environment in which we don't really get all of the information, and the type of information we get isn't the type of information we really truly want or need or demand. But of course, that's the nature of the issue that we deal with today, whereby, you know, it is trial by public opinion. And yes, of course, organizations are looking to mitigate or reduce the impact of the bad press, the bad publicity. And I think that's understandable, because there is this construct called the abnormal churn rate. And so an organization that's been compromised, there's a theoretical statistic which says these are the number of customers that will leave you. And so, of course, they want to try to reduce the impact. And if there is the opportunity to be able to absolve themselves of the blame, then some organizations will try to do that. There are other organizations that are completely open and entirely transparent. But, you know, there isn't kind of a playbook where every organization does this or does that. We do see like varying different degrees or approaches.
Okay, so Raj, there's a couple of things in there that you said which was interesting. You mentioned that if you look at a breach, for example, the specific details you say or you believe people are very focused on things that you believe people shouldn't be focused on. Can you give an example of, from your experience, what people are focused on the wrong thing?
Well, I think attribution becomes one of the most hotly contested and discussed topics there are. You know, who was behind the attack? And we've called it attribution roulette, whereby, you know, you kind of roll the dice and you see, well, who's going to be in the frame for this attack this week? I think it's important to try to understand the source of the attack, but not for the purpose of trying to, you know, get more clicks, for example. Understanding attribution is important so we can start to map out the tools and tactics and procedures being used by various different threat groups. That allows us the opportunity to be able to implement detection and protection against specific threat groups. It shouldn't be used as a vehicle to try and generate more coverage. And, you know, equally, there has to be a bar with regards to what leads us towards that conclusion. So, for example, if we ever do things such as attribution, and certainly public attribution, we'll go through a series of measures to determine the confidence that we believe, or that will lead us to believe, the root cause of the problem or the root cause of the attack. So you think to yourself, well, you know, rather than, for example, and I've seen this in the past, whereby, you know, somebody looked at an IP address and said, well, that IP address is coming from this country, therefore it's this country doing the attack. Well, it's very simple to mitigate that. And actually, we see campaigns whereby threat groups put in these false flags, which make you believe, oh, actually, it's somebody else as opposed to another threat group. And so there is this kind of game of cat and mouse where attribution is being used. And when I talk about attribution, what I mean by that is drawing a conclusion as to the root cause or the source of a particular threat attack. Unfortunately, this is the thing that these are the headlines that drive the clicks, that drive the coverage, that drives. And so we need to be, I think, probably more grown up with regards to how we treat attributing specific threats and specific attacks.
Yeah, I do hear what you're saying. But even if you watch, like, I don't know, a press conference, the first thing that the CEO says is, oh, you know, our suspicion is a threat actor is from X, you know, country or whatever it is. So I do notice that a lot. So, and I do understand. And as you mentioned before, it is important. But from what I'm hearing from what you're saying, it's just not maybe what people should lead with straight out the gate. So what would you then suggest people should be focused on as a, like, yeah, attribution is 100% important. People do want to know, you know, where the attack came from. But you sort of mentioned before that people should be focused on other things. What are those other things people should be sort of thinking about initially?
The key thing is to be open and transparent about the scope of the attack. And look, there may be components of the attack which are sensitive, so you can't disclose. But making things available and accessible to the wider industry about the artifacts of a specific breach, for example. So what I'd love to be able to see is organizations being transparent and saying, look, this is what we know thus far. This is what we can publicly share. Oh, and by the way, you know, these are the tactics that we use, or these are the, you know, we call them indicators of compromise, for example. So these are the assets, or these are the kind of tricks that the criminals used in order to break in. Now, that becomes important because other organizations that are also being targeted by the same threat group, potentially by the same playbook, as it were, can then use the accessible or available information in order to protect themselves. You know, we've often said that cybersecurity is a team sport, but it seems more often than not that many of these team players are less than collaborative. And so, and that's not everybody, by the way. There are, you know, there was a breach, I think it was this week or last week, where a security vendor actually were very open and very transparent about the tools and tactics being used. And so making that information accessible allows other organizations the opportunity to protect themselves. Collectively, as a society, we're very, very quick to point the finger whether if somebody's been breached or not. What the conversation probably needs to move towards is, hey, look, you know, everybody has the potential to be breached. The fundamental question we've got to ask ourselves is, did the organization that got compromised take all reasonable measures to protect your data or information about you? And if that organization did take reasonable measures, then rather than vilifying them, what we should probably do is say, well, okay, what was it about this attack that allowed them to successfully get in, and what do we need to do to, in order to stop this happening in the future? If an organization gets compromised and their password was 123456 and they completely missed every alert, then okay, there is a question of, well, they didn't take reasonable measures. And so I think there's got to be more of a balanced view with regards to breaches, as opposed to this, well, they got compromised, so therefore they must be terrible. You know, that I think is an unhealthy approach, because then what it does is it creates this, back to your point, it creates this environment in which, you know, like you said, like somebody will stand up and say, well, it was a sophisticated attack done by a country, so there's nothing we could have done. Well, whether it's a nation state or an organized crime group, it's still, you know, they're still compromising systems. They're still criminals. And so, you know, they're not superheroes. So that I think starts to become a really necessary kind of part of the discussion we need to have.
I like the part where you said reasonable measures, because you're so right. So, for example, I don't know whether you follow news out here in Australia, but there's been multiple very large breaches here. And now I think people are desensitizing themselves. It's like so-and-so company got breached. Then I think that's where, for majority of people, the conversation stops. Rather than saying, like you said, was there reasonable measures that they did try to protect your data or whatever it may be? Or was it password 1234 and missed all the alerts and no other security controls at all? So I think that now, if I look on the consumer lens of it, it's more like, oh, okay, so another company got breached, who cares? They failed us. That's sort of the commentary I'm seeing from large media sites, with I read the comments from people saying that, you know, even talent from a cybersecurity perspective in Australia is horrendous, like pretty bad stuff, right? So, but I think they're not doing that extra little bit of the missing piece, which you mentioned before, the reasonable measures. But then it gets hard, because I was talking to someone the other day. They're like, yeah, but sometimes, KB, when you're out here and you've got stress and then you've got legal counsel then on your back to say you can only say X amount of things, and then like it's one day in and people want an update but you don't really have all the information. Then if you do another update 2 days later, it's maybe it was 20% data you thought was stolen, then it was 40, and in 7 days' time, it's 100%. So he's like, it's really hard to manage those expectations from internally, from regulators, as well as consumers and customers. So do you think that, you know, I don't envy these people in these positions that have to get up there and sort of really take a massive hit. So I'm just curious to know, like, what your thoughts are on that.
Look, it's never easy being in the middle of an incident. And I've been in the middle of more incidents than I probably, you know, care to do in any lifetime. And, you know, you see a lot of varying different reactions. But there is a way, I think, to be open and transparent in a way that doesn't potentially compromise you. And look, I remember this case I dealt with a little while back, and it was in the Asia Pacific region. You know, when we got inside and started to do the analysis, what we realized was the threat actors had been inside for a number of years. Now, the furore internally was, oh, kick them out. We need to throw the adversaries out of the network. And, you know, when we started to have the discussion with the senior leadership team, it's like, look, you've got criminals inside your network. Now, if we take the action to close the back doors of the network, they've been in here so long that the risk you have is they've actually created additional ways into your environment. Now, throwing them out, i.e. closing the doors of what we know today, introduces a risk that they're going to come in via a different mechanism and completely like destroy the network, because they're going to want to cover as many tracks as they possibly can. So what I recommend we do, and I know this sounds really difficult, is we leave them in the environment, we monitor everything that they do, we watch what they do, and then we have the opportunity to be able to find more backdoors into your network, and then we can close everything. So we scheduled what we call a strike day. So that strike day was, hey, we've been monitoring them for a period of time. We know how they're getting in. We know all of their backup ways to get in. Now we're going to close every single door, every single window, lock it and shut it tightly. And at the time, I was like, well, they're never going to go for this. What will happen is we'll end up kicking them out. And then in a week later, I'll get phoned and said, hey, by the way, the network's been toast. But what was interesting was the company was like, well, look, we understand that. We understand the need for it. Let's go ahead and proceed with that. And I think that one surprised me, because I never expected them to accept that, because it was the right approach. Taking the right course of action or the most appropriate course of action can be painful, but in the long term, it can be truly beneficial. And I think probably what changed it all was we were able to provide a very, very clear plan. We were able to mitigate the risks that they had identified. And we were very clear about the timeline that we would take the action. And I think, you know, in the middle of a breach, you're dealing with regulatory pressures, law enforcement, you're dealing with press, you're dealing with legal, you're dealing with all of these kind of swirling things. But I think if you're very clear and concise about what you're doing, why you're doing it, then I think you've got a more higher likelihood to be able to take that course of action. Ultimately you have the opportunity to be able to control the narrative. Yeah, and there's been multiple cases in the past where people have said, no, we're not going to do what you recommend. We're going to do what we think is right. And then, you know, I remember one case where I got a call like 3 weeks later saying, oh, by the way, we've been compromised again. And this time it's even worse than what it was the first time. And so for me, it's about actually being clear and concise about what you want to do and why you want to do it. And of course, ultimately, you know, from a security perspective, it's not your decision. You know, you are consulting for the business, whether you're a CISO, whether you're a vendor, whether you're a consultant. So you have to listen to what the business is demanding. But ultimately, as the expert, you can provide your input into that. And there are cases in which senior leadership do listen.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. So before I ask a couple of questions off the back of your previous statements, I'm curious then to know, so if I were to sort of close the loop on a lot of your lessons, because you have worked historically alongside of like law enforcement, would you say that your like depth and breadth towards incidents and cases has maybe solidified then your approach? Because I've interviewed a number of people that have done your field of work, or they've worked more on the, you know, DFIR front or more in the incident response sort of area. You just seem to bring probably a very unique angle. So would you say that your unique angle comes from your experience working alongside law enforcement, which gives you a different sort of lens to apply?
No, I think it's all of the above. You know, it's our experience which shapes us, and it's, you know, being involved with cases 20 years ago with things like Blaster and NIMDA and, you know, or WannaCry or like all of the above, I think has shaped the thinking. And, you know, a lot of the thinking and a lot of the approach, the entirety of my approach is being very crystal clear about the impact, the capability of a threat actor, but also what I believe to be the best course of action. Look, I genuinely believe the best course of action in any breach is to be open and transparent. The one thing that I've learned it's been decades since I'm working in this industry, is stuff will eventually get out. Like whether you try to hide, whether you try to obfuscate, or if you're going to try to pretend that something wasn't as bad, things will eventually get out. And the criminals have actually acknowledged and recognized this. And so the whole growth of this double extortion tactic, whereby, you know, ransomware threat actors will steal information and then publicly disclose that. They're doing that because they know that organizations have in the past tried to either downplay or even entirely kind of obfuscate the fact that they've been compromised. Now, with double extortion, you can't do that anymore. And so I would argue today that organizations, if you've been compromised, don't look at that as the death knell of your business. What could be the death knell of the business is how you handle it. There are thousands of companies that have been compromised, tens of thousands of companies that have been compromised, and almost all of them have come out of the other side of it. But I would argue the companies that come out the best are the ones that have been open, been transparent, you know, not tried to hide, not tried to obfuscate this, considered the data subjects, considered the potential harm to the data subjects, and put in measures in order to be able to reduce the impact to the customers that have entrusted them with their data. That, for me, is probably the most critical component. And for me, I think that that's what my experience will lead to, which is, hey, look, just you know, everybody's gone through this at some point, but those that have gone through it and come out the best have been the ones that have been the most transparent.
So it's going back to your comment before around controlling the narrative. Now, this is so interesting because more often than not, what do you often hear from people? Oh, they didn't handle it very well. Oh, the CEO was, like you said, obfuscating, or they weren't transparent. They weren't open. But then do you feel it's like you're damned if you do by someone, you're damned if you don't? Now, I know that sounds like a dumb question because, you know, you're never going to make everyone in the world happy no matter who you are, what you are, and what you're saying. But would you say that more often than not, at the moment, more companies from your experience have lost control of the narrative?
Well, I think with the advent of social media, I think people try and control the narrative anyway. And people will just draw natural conclusions in the absence of clarity anyway. So I think that's part of the reason why I say, well, it's important to be narrow, it's important to be transparent, it's important to be open, and it's important to share the information that you have for the benefit of the industry. If you are going to intentionally withhold information, then people will just make stuff up anyway, whether it's true or not. And for me, I think that's what I mean by controlling the narrative. It is about saying, well, look, this is what's happened. This is what we've learned thus far. And actually, really importantly, you know, ensuring that you are working with law enforcement, because it's imperative that we try to hold those behind these attacks accountable, and making that information accessible and available so that other organizations have the intelligence in order to be able to protect their own systems against this particular tactic. That, for me, is controlling the narrative. Whereas trying to hide it or even not sharing the necessary information in a timely way then means people are just going to make up their own stories regardless. You know, is this organization being compromised? Oh, yeah, well, we think it has. And there are entire social media accounts dedicated towards publishing information about the double extortion victims that exist. And so that was remarkable. I was looking at a Twitter feed the other day, and this person had got like 10 to 15, I think it was 2,000 retweets on screenshots of a ransomware victim's disclosure. So like, you know, the ransomware group had said, oh, we'd compromised this bank. And like this channel had got like 1,500 retweets on it. And I was just stunned, like, wow, that's an incredible amount of publicity. And I think at the time, the bank hadn't even said anything or responded, or maybe they didn't even know. So the narrative had already been taken away from them because of these researchers that are publishing information continuously and constantly. And so that's the challenge that we face, is that in some cases, you may not even know about it. Or if you do know about it and you're thinking, well, actually, can I take a couple of days just to figure out what's going on? Actually, the story's already broken and it's got a huge amount of publicity already.
Yeah, I know exactly. I know exactly what you mean. And I think that was sort of in the earlier part of our interview by saying, well, you know, when the story changes, like whether it's another vendor that got their version of the story or some random person on social media that has a view, and then all of a sudden you don't have a lot of those gaps filled, then people just start believing what other people say and then buying into their story. Now, I guess that, you know, it goes back into on the consumer front on where you get your information and your sources from. But I think it's really important to know that you probably will always have a degree of feeling like you lose control of that narrative because you can't control what media companies write about you and what they want to tell in their stories. You can't control what Sally on Instagram thinks when she doesn't have any idea about what really happened. And I think that's just the nature of the world. So would you say that for people that are listening, be prepared that even if you came out, you were transparent, you were open, you were honest, you were quite descriptive with what happened, there's always going to be an element of someone will have a different opinion, or someone is always going to think that they know more than what you've sort of said. Is there always going to be that no matter how well you've handled that narrative?
Natural skepticism has been probably more amplified now that we offer this kind of pseudo-anonymity. And so, you know, what I mean by that is people are more emboldened to be more divisive, more, I guess, more angry. You know, I call it these kind of digital pitchforks, but they're more happy to kind of take up arms when there is this perceived level of lack of, you know, when there's this perceived level of lack of risk by typing things out on a keyboard. And, you know, you see this within this, you know, social networks and social media, whereby there is this kind of greater toxicity that exists digitally than it does physically in the physical world. And so, yeah, like I've been a victim of this myself, where, you know, we've said certain things or posted certain things, and there are individuals that will come out and say, well, you know, that's terrible, I don't agree, but do so in a way that's entirely disrespectful or entirely unhelpful. And so I think, like, this digital world that exists anyway. And, you know, we see this today where in the UK, for example, we left the, you know, the European Union in 2016. And you look at the level of discourse between various different groups, and it's, you know, it's not a constructive debate. It's just throwing barbs at one another left and right with memes thrown in as well. So that exists now anyway. Yeah. And you know, that, and I think that's the worry, really, which is the whole purpose of social media and social networks, I believe, was to enable people to be able to connect, the ability to be able to shape opinions. But what we've done is just double down on our own opinions. And if somebody disagrees with us, well, let me go after them with everything that I have. And so our world remains affected by this, by the same approach, whereby, well, yeah, you didn't say this, so therefore that this is what I think. Or, well, you published this report and you said it was this threat group. Well, I think you're full of crap, and so let me tell you why you're terrible. You know, so that, I think, is just the very nature of the broader kind of social society that we live in today, whereby people are a lot more comfortable and a lot more confident and a lot more emboldened to be as vociferous as they possibly can.
So if we look forward with, you know, some of your experiences that you've shared today and previously working on the ground alongside law enforcement, what would you sort of say would be some of your insights as we traverse into a more connected digital world? Like, what are some of maybe, like, do you have any insights or concerns? And I understand, like, you're not Nostradamus and you don't have every answer. Just more so curious to sort of hear your thoughts, because you have seen the space change over the years. So I'm just curious to see if you've got anything to sort of leave our audience with today.
Well, I think probably the big thing that I talk about is we started in a world in which cybersecurity was about computer viruses, and it was about IT systems. And if we think about what cybersecurity really and truly is, it is so much more than that. And we've seen examples whereby elections have been, well, people have made the assertions that elections have been swayed through misinformation. And, you know, cybersecurity for me has far more reach than just, for example, the computer sitting in your home. It's absolutely fundamental to our way of life, or to how we as a society will operate, whether that's, you know, like I said, whether it's about propaganda or misinformation, whether it's about people being able to receive patient care, whether it's about, I guess, you know, the way that we're going to pay one another through online currency exchanges, i.e. cryptocurrencies. We are going to become so much more dependent upon the confidentiality of data, the integrity of information, and the availability of systems. We collectively, not governments, not private sector, not individuals, we collectively need to do more to acknowledge that. Because, like I think you touched on it earlier, which is people have become so numb to breaches that they almost ignore it. But I always say that, look, once your information is out, it is out. And then that can then be weaponized and used against you. And so for me, I'd like to see a broader acknowledgement that cybersecurity is and fundamental to our way of life. And we need to start to put in measures to be able to reduce the impact that criminals effectively criminals are having upon our natural way of life. You know, like we touched upon it earlier, which is the Brexit vote. Well, there's been assertions that the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal was something that helped influence the elections. And when you really start to break that down, it's incredible to think that actually that's the potential that it could have. And so I think we've got to have this broader acknowledgement that cybersecurity is much broader and wider than what we have initially thought it to be. It's not about just protecting that computer from a computer virus. Actually, it's about shaping public opinion. It's about, you know, our ability to receive patient care, as I said. So I think it's, for me, as I look forward, we are going to continue to be entirely dependent upon digital systems and the accessibility and availability of information that hasn't been, you know, purposely misinformed. And that becomes imperative. And look, you know, we saw this with COVID, for example, with the rise of huge, huge amounts of misinformation being conducted and carried out by either people that were misinformed or people with the sole intent of trying to inform the public.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I totally forgot about that. So true. So just going back to your acknowledgement piece for a moment. Do you believe we have got the acknowledgement, or do you think it's, as we mentioned before, this is more of a forward conversation? Do you think that will come in due course and over the years we will get more acknowledgement about the impact cybersecurity has on consumers and businesses?
No, I don't think we're anywhere near that at all. You know, we are blindly installing apps. We are blindly accepting terms and conditions. We aren't having the bigger discussions that I think we need to be having, which is, you know, like in 3 to 5 years' time, we're going to have autonomous vehicles on the road, you know, natural part of our lives. We haven't started to discuss things such as, well, okay, where does the liability sit if there is an accident? You know, like we are just blindly accepting more technology, more features, more capabilities. We're becoming more and more dependent upon these things. And, you know, we saw in 2016 with WannaCry, for example, an attack that starts in one part of the world within hours goes and infects the rest of the part. And the question became, well, okay, the speed with which interconnected systems can be compromised was absolutely frightening. But the question becomes, well, if that happens again, have we taken our lessons learned from that and actually have the opportunity? Well, I don't know if we collectively have, because yet again, we're continually and entirely interconnected. And so I don't know if we've started to have these. I know we're having these discussions, but like, here's the question, you know, if there is another vote tomorrow, is it possible for somebody that is well-skilled and well-capable to be able to potentially spread misinformation using the platforms we depend upon today? And you and I know the answer to that is probably yes. If there is a botnet, for example, that started in one part of the world, is it possible to spread around the entire world in a matter of minutes? Well, yeah, probably still is. And so these fundamental weaknesses, I think you could call it, or the interconnected nature by which we gather information or our systems are connected, still exist. I don't believe we have really fundamentally asked these questions yet and actually put in the mechanisms in order to reduce the likelihood of that happening again.
Information warfare, that is a separate topic on its own, which is super interesting. And yes, I agree with you. There is the mechanism to misconstrue voting and people's opinions. So that on its own is a separate problem in a separate piece. But Raj, I've absolutely enjoyed having this conversation with you today. I, you know, was just really listening to what you were saying and just curious about not only your experience, but your opinions and your thoughts towards how people should be handling and responding to breaches, and also doing a little bit of a deeper dive into your work alongside law enforcement. So I really appreciate the time, you waking up early today and coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to KBI.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.